They made the child lie across something and they beat him with a belt. Or, and prior to beating him with, and one guy was sitting there eating a hamburger, beating this child with a belt. And I thought, oh, I can't hardly look at it because I have a lot of patience with a lot of things, but I have no patience with somebody that abuses children. And so I have to pull myself back and say, okay, usually an abuser was abused. That's why it's so important for if we can, we require reporters that we report it so they can get some help and break that cycle. Because if that cycle's never broken, what happens to it? I think it's okay. Go ahead. Go on with you. Yeah. So, and a lot of times, a lot of abuse occurs during pregnancy when women are pregnant. You hear them, I mean, they've been kicked in the stomach or they've been beat a lot. And women that are abused during pregnancy, you'll learn, will have a lot of pregnancy complications. I call it low birth weight. They don't gain the normal amount of weight they should gain. A lot of infections. They just don't do as well. And a lot of them, the fetus does not live to viability. And sometimes, okay, when a pregnant lady is coming in with a lot of different issues like that, and you figure out they're being abused, it's a prime time to intervene during the hospitalization and pull them out of that situation. So read through that. Women, men are abused, just not as much. There's also psychological abuse, which is almost kind of harder to identify than physical abuse, because at least, you know, with physical abuse, you have what? A bruise, a bobo, you know, something you can see. Psychological abuse, you can't see it. In talking with someone who was being psychologically and emotionally abused, you have to be careful, you know, to say, well, you're being psychologically, you know, you have to say, well, no one has a right to talk to you that way. Everyone, you know, you are a human being. You have self-worth. You're important. You have to let them know, because a lot of times they've been talked to, so you're no good. You're this, you're that, you're stupid. You know, nobody else would have you. That you have to let them know more than once that's just not okay. Has anybody ever known anybody that's been psychologically abused?
Yeah, I've been psychologically abused by my ex-husband.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I know I'm a wonderful and great person, and I know that he's the jerk.
Exactly. You see, that's what you have. That's where you want to go with that. But there are a lot of people that stay in emotionally abusive relationships because it just takes a while to get out of them. There's always an element of control that the person either has difficult, they have children that they can't provide for, they feel trapped, not only physically, but emotionally in that relationship. Because you will hear people say sometimes, well, why don't they just get out? Just get out. Now, as nurses, you're going to run into that abused child or a woman or elderly person a lot of times in the ER, okay? An elderly person is sometimes scared to say anything because they won't take care of them anymore. They're threatening with putting them in a nursing home, you know, all of those kinds of things. So there's an element of I have no place to go and I control you in all of it, okay? And with a child, you think about it, that a child, who do you trust? Who's the first people you trust?
Your parents.
And even though they abuse you, you still love them. They are your parents. So there's a lot of ambivalence there that they don't want to get their parents in trouble, they'll tell you. I had a little boy when I worked that he said, he'd say, they're dropping me off because they're all going on a cruise. They'll come back and get me in 2 weeks. And sure enough, they did. So if you look at the power and control thing of chart on page 762, you'll see coercion and threats, intimidation, emotional abuse. They usually isolate the person too, away from all their friends and family. Minimizing, denial, and blaming. They use the children. Males usually abuse more than females abuse males. That's just the way it is. and economic abuse. The only thing that with children that may be a little bit different here is that a lot of times the child in the family that is abused is either seen as different or is different. They may have, for example, special needs, okay? There's teen partner abuse, okay? A lot of teens report that. 10% of teens reported being struck, hit in a survey. There's stalking, right? You ever heard of somebody that's been stalked? You know, the movie stars get stalked, but average people get stalked too, also get stalked, okay? That's a way of intimidating somebody. Yeah, there's rape and sexual assault. Rape is not a sexual act, okay? Rape is control, intimidation. You know, it's a violent crime. You know, if you wanted to have sex with somebody, you'd probably go to town, found five people, okay? I'm just saying, you don't have to rape somebody for sexual pleasure unless it's deviant. And it has nothing to do with that. It is violent, okay? Dominate, intimidate, or it's probably more than 93%. That's just what we know about, go unreported. 1 in 5 women, 1 in 20 men, okay? And it's usually perpetrated by somebody they know. And 32,000 unwanted pregnancies a year. And it is an act of domination. Now, what I'm going to say to you, there is, if a victim comes in the emergency room, okay, they have, you know, get a physical assessment and all that. But there are usually, most facilities have now what we call a sane nurse, sexually assaultive, nurse examiner, sexually assaultive nurse examiner. And they can do the physical exam. There's a pelvic exam, there's bodily fluid exam, there's all of that. It's a form that's followed. Even if the person does not want to report the rape at that point in time, if the nurse can persuade them to go ahead and meet with the same nurse and let her collect the evidence, because they might decide in the morning what? They do want to report the person, right? And if they've gone home and taken a shower and all of those kinds of things, what happens there? You've washed away all your evidence. So, you know, and you have to think, if somebody's just been raped and molested, that a pelvic exam and the things that go with that, you have to get a sample of pubic hair, semen, all of that, is not something that you're going to want right at that point in time. Because what do most people you think would want to do? Take a bath, take a shower, okay? So that's something that we as nurses, as advocates, can, you know, encourage them to do, stay with them, support them. And most of your sane nurses are educated, they are trained in the physical examination techniques, and they do a good job of it. Now, there's child maltreatment too. There's abuse, words, actions, harm, cause threat and harm, and then there's neglect, where we don't provide the child what they need. Now, a lot of times too, teachers are the ones that see this, okay? Anybody got a friend that's a teacher?
Most of my friends are teachers. My family's all teachers, and I was a teacher for 8 years.
Okay, I happen to have a family member. My older daughter is a teacher, and teachers and nurses, you know, we have a lot in common. We're enablers. We like to give care. We like to, you know, we're kind, caring people, the majority of us. Y'all agree with that? There's always a bad egg and a bad apple in the bunch, but you know, but teachers see a lot of neglect, okay? And some signs of abuse. They are required reporters. We are required reporters. Social workers are required reporters. Anybody that is in the caring business, you could say. And you know, we're protected by the law. We can't be sued for slander or anything like that, okay? We are protected by the law as required reporters. So remember that. If you suspect, you report. Because usually when your intuition says you suspect, there's something not quite right there, okay? There's also children that are abused or neglected or at risk for so many other comorbidities. Learning difficulties, low self-esteem, all of those issues go along with it, okay? And physical abuse, what? You can see anal tears, rectal tears. You can see just all kinds of bad things that happen. You can see children come in with sexually transmitted diseases, okay? Because they've been sexually molested and abused. So it's most of the time, it's a family member and they're hesitant to report it because it could be old Uncle Jim that everybody likes, okay? A lot of children are, when they do report it, what? They're not believed. So what? I'd say 99.999% of the time you believe the child, right? And you investigate by reporting it. These children also what can be suicidal. Sometimes that's the only way they see out. So remember that if you see a child come in with like you can tell with a brush, you know, there's that brushing, there's that hand imprint, there's cigarette burns, there's hair missing, they have sexually transmitted diseases, or they're very sexually knowledgeable for a 5-year-old. Do y'all follow there? They've been exposed to things that they should not have been exposed to at that age. And if you're an ER nurse, and some of you will want to do that, you will see a lot of it. I got called to the ER one night, and a mother brought a child in a coma, okay? And has it taken anything? Now, you realize that these are clinical examples. Have taken anything? Anything happened that would cause a child, you know, no fever, no this, no that. Finally, when I said, well, let's just go ahead and get a drug screen. And I said it loud enough where it could be heard. And all of a sudden, the child had consumed a whole bottle of Lortab. Okay? The outcome was not good there. So you're going to see a lot of neglect, abuse in an ER. So be in tune. Elder abuse. It can, you know, money, threatening, not feeding them. You know, it can be physical, it can be psychological, and it can also be sexual in nature. And usually what? They're in a vulnerable position, and it's the caregiver. You can read through the theories of violence as you go through it. 766. The cycle of violence, I want you to look at that, okay? That do you see the picture there at the bottom where you say tension building, minor incidents, establishes total control, total acquisition, isolates them, degrades them, the violence occurs, and then what happens? Then I come home and I say, I'm so sorry. Here's you 3 dozen red roses. This will never happen again. Then it starts all over again, okay? And I talked to you about the factors about staying versus leaving. So what if you know that this person has been abused, okay, and they're going back into the home as an advocate for that person? What would I want to tell them, nurses? What do I want to tell them? Okay, I want to tell them, pack you a suitcase, hide it, be ready to leave there, okay? This is where you can go. This is a safe house. There's one in every town. Stash you some money away. Put your credit card up. Have an extra set of keys to your car. And think of when is the best time for you to leave that situation. Be ready to go. Because what? At some point, I'm going to get the nerve to do that, and I'm going to do it. Would you think a therapeutic relationship would be very important? Because I'm not going to be very trusting, am I? So that therapeutic relationship, a quiet place where you can talk privately with them. And let me tell you something, a lot of times when they're in the hospital, when they're there because of their physical injuries, okay, what, the abuser's in the room with them. So they can't talk to you. So you might want to say, hey, I've got a few things I need to do to get her settled or the child settled. Why don't you go down to the cafeteria and get you something to eat and get a cup of coffee? I'll be here and, you know, take about 30 minutes with. I'm sure you need that. Because most of them, you know what, they're kind of a little bit narcissistic. So that I'm sure you need that. You're probably hungry and thirsty. And then maybe what, you can form that therapeutic bond with the victim in private. Okay? The first thing we want to do is on page 767 is when we're screening that lethal assessment, okay? Is that person in danger for his or her life either by homicide or suicide? Is there a weapon in the home? Do the suicide assessment, all of those things, okay? Because you what? You're important, worried about the safety of that. And if you suspect it, what? You don't have to have proof of it, you can report it. If you look on page 768, excuse me, there is a danger assessment screen that you will see used in ERs. Okay? There's abuse assessment screen on page 769, and there's also the Burgess Partner Abuse screen for teenagers, right? So look at all of those screenings, okay? So if you turn to page 770, they have to have what? A thorough physical assessment. Because a lot of these patients, what? They suffer from PTSD, flashbacks, depression, all of that, okay? So they have to have a thorough physical assessment, do a history of their injuries, okay? And then, of course, the psychosocial assessment. How fearful are you? Self-esteem, guilt, and shame. And they go through those with you. If you look on page 771, there are some, just kind of scan that. It's kind of what I told you. They give you a whole gamut of physical findings that are suggestive of abuse, okay? Family history, health and psychiatric history. And, you know, when you look at it, it's like I told you, the skin's got a lot of bruising, welts, different stages of healing, eyes, black eyes, retinal hemorrhages, ears, hearing loss, because I punched in the ear so much, a lot of lacerations and things around the mouth, the abdomen. And like I said, there can be a lot of injury in the gonadourinary system or the rectum there, and the musculoskeletal system, all of bones, contractures. Let's see. One of the things, remember I told you everybody's got a social network. You have one starting with your patient in the middle, and the further you have to go out, then the more dependency what that you'll meet on the healthcare system. So look at their social network and basically to see how isolated they are. Because these people are, you know, victims are very isolated. So what's your nursing interventions? Physical things first, okay? Physical, you have to stabilize them physiologically, and that's based on the injuries, right? I've got broken bones, what? And I've got a cast, what are you gonna check me for? Make sure my toes are warm and blanching and I've got good circulatory, what? Return to them. If I've got a head injury, you're gonna be doing neuro checks on me. If I have lost a lot of blood and had surgery, what? Y'all are in that med-surg part right now, what? Vital signs, fluid and electrolyte balances, fluid volume deficit, pain management, right? And then we're going to get into promoting healthy activities. That's where what we're going to do, what? Get them in some cognitive behavioral therapy and help them survive, right? A lot of times too,
what's wrong?
Survivors who have a co-occurring substance abuse disorder. Why? Sometimes I have to medicate myself to tolerate what I'm living in. So that may have to be addressed, okay? about children.
Aggressively in other situations, like at school, and hurting other people because they're being hurt at home. It's like the kick the dog syndrome.
Right. You're right. You know, they have a violence vocabulary, and they need to learn to talk about what happened to them and express it, and need to learn, you know, that they're going to be in a safe environment. And it's not okay for people to treat you like that. And it's not your fault, okay? Main thing, it is not your fault. No one deserves to be treated like that. A lot of times too, play therapy is very good for them. Children may not have a big vocabulary, but they can act it out through play therapy, okay? You can see how they treat a doll. So you'll see a lot of play therapy with children that have been abused, okay? Music, having them draw things, and working with them to help them decrease their anxiety levels and learn better ways to, you know, learn ways to cope and move into a safe environment. Anger, survivors are angry. And we just talked about anger, and we have to help them learn what? How to cope with it, how to express it, how to be assertive rather than aggressive. So we have to help them work through that. And this will go, and survivors need some, you know, need some, I'm a big believer in the cognitive behavioral therapy to work with them. And it's not going to occur overnight. Abuse didn't happen just one time. Anxiety, some survivors do have PTSD, and that has to be recognized and addressed, okay? And always there's what? There's hope. You have strength. You have hope. The family is brought into it, because a lot of times too, what, they don't know how to have, they don't have child management skills or household organizational skills. And then again, anger management with them. And then we always evaluate our treatment outcomes. And last but not least, if the partner, you know, that's doing the abusing is a husband, someone that is going to be in that child's life, or that child is going to ask a lot of questions about, or that wife, or whatever the abuse is, that partner needs to be what? Put into some interventions also, okay? A lot of them do end up what? In the judicial system. And even if they don't, into the judicial system, you know, their needs need to be addressed there too. Because what? They may come back around, and you want to be prepared for that. And you want them to have the education, what? Also, if they do. And a lot of times too, if you can break that cycle, I'm a strong believer, you can break that cycle, then you can protect future generations in that family.
When y'all read this, in the family, if he goes on to another relationship, he'd be abusive in that one.
Even if very good point. You're very good point. So we don't want to turn them loose on the world and somebody else, do we? No. And I will tell you this: we have a tendency in life to be attracted to the same type of partners. Okay. And if you're not careful and you don't get what you need, cognitive behavioral therapy and support, and go on through the mental health system and get the help that you need, you might end up in another abusive relationship. That's very common. So both parties, you know, need the help for that reason. Any questions that y'all may have? Read that, and if you do have any, you know, we can talk about it. I think we'll have some time next week too. So if you think of questions, write them down. Dr. Alexander, you got anything to add?
No, you covered it great.
So what we're going to do, nurses, physiological needs, make sure they get their emotional needs addressed, safe place to go, keep your suitcase packed, right? And any time that you are in a place where you see that patient coming in with this injury and that injury and this injury and that, suspect, all is not well.
I have a quick question. Are we reporters in every aspect, like outside of our workplace as well? Like if we see signs that a child is being abused in the neighborhood, are we obligated to report in that instance as well?
You can.
Okay.
But you are definitely obligated to the workplace. I think the sad thing about after you've been a nurse for some time, the child's been reported and reported and reported, and we try to keep the children in the home now as much as possible. You know, but you can't. Anything else y'all want to talk about before we sign off? Y'all good? Okay, if you think of anything, bring your questions next week and we can answer them when you read through it. And a lot of this, y'all, is very common sense. Common sense. A lot of nursing is common sense. Okay.
And y'all relate this back to, like, if somebody suffers some type of abuse or trauma. You know, that's that acute stress disorder, and they're probably numb and can't remember details and everything at first, okay? And that's why early intervention and everything is needed to keep it from progressing into PTSD and that type of thing. So that's how it all ties together. Think of what you're going to do. You know, somebody experiencing acute trauma, violence, they're going to have to be given specific step-by-step instructions, and you need to make sure they're referred out to the right place and that they have all available resources and stuff like that. So tie what you've learned, you know, with like acute stress disorder and everything into this too. All right? That's all.
See y'all later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I want to point out some, just talk about anger for a minute, because, you know, anger is a universal feeling that we all have. Don't y'all get angry sometimes? Yeah. And if it becomes, you know, maladaptive as far as us getting angry, what it can lead to some pretty violent behavior. And we see that a lot in our society today. I mean, look what's going on out there. Just a lot of people mad at each other, and, you know, it gets physical and hollering and screaming and all this kind of stuff in our society today, which is kind of scary when you really think about it, huh? That's the way people are displaying. I always call it, you know, maladaptive communication. And you think about, there's road rage, there's temper tantrums, there's all this inappropriate display of the emotion of anger. You know, we all get frustrated, we all get hostile sometimes, but, you know, most of us, what, we don't cross over to that hatred and rage. You know, we have coping mechanisms and things, what, we can do, what, to help with some of that. So hopefully, you know, it's just to let you understand that as a nurse, people don't come to the hospital because they have a choice of going, what, to Disneyland or the hospital. So they're coming into the hospital setting and what? They're not in their best, what? Their best anyway. They're scared, they're frustrated, and some are angry because, you know, they're sick, that kind of thing. So, but with most people, what? Angry is an affective state, meaning it's a mood. And what do? If you look at it, we work through it, we express it. But anger, you know, can be a symptom there's something wrong. And if you kind of make a little U shape, upside down U on your paper, you know, like a little bell curve, upside down U, you know, people start getting angry at the bottom of that curve, okay? And then it begins to escalate. If they reach the top of that curve, you know, the other side goes down. It takes a while before what? They can come down. So One of the things in nursing we want to do is what? We want to recognize those symptoms. Because what? Anger is usually a response to something that we feel that we need. Y'all agree with that? And I can tell you something. Communication is so important when you're in the hospital setting because of that potential for anger. Emergency rooms, psych areas, anywhere where there's something acute going on. It's just, and usually the person that is angry is as uncomfortable as they can be. And what happens to others around you? Don't you get uncomfortable when somebody is, quote, what I used to say, showing out? Don't you want to tell them just to kind of, come on now, let's sit down and talk about it. So one of the most important things that you can remember is to recognize what? That is beginning to happen, and that is beginning to escalate if we don't intervene, what, and do something. Find out what the patient needs, what the patient thinks they need, what they may, you know, we need things and we want things. So that can be two different things. And I heard a nurse say the other day, she was very, very frustrated, and she said, you know, they think this is the Holiday Inn. You know, warm towels, order off the dinner menu, those kinds of things. So people's expectations when they come into the healthcare setting, what, can be very demanding, can they not? And, you know, it doesn't do any good to say, to go in there and say, well, you know, we're short staffed tonight. I don't care about that. That just adds to it. You know, hospital can't hire enough to take care of us, but yet what? They're going to charge us $20 for one aspirin. You see how that cycle can just get going. So just be careful. So people have a lot of anger. And, you know, the older theory of depression was anger turned inward. They couldn't express it. They turned all of that inward and ended up in a depressed state. So can you think if you couldn't express your anger in an appropriate way? I'm not talking about maladaptive anger where you get physical, you hoop, you scream, you holler, and you know the kind of anger I'm talking about. But if you couldn't say, express your uncomfortable feelings or you that hurt your feelings or it kind of made you mad in a comfortable environment, what would happen? You would kind of turn it inward and it would build and build and build. And after some point, what, people will blow. If you look on page 283, and I think it's at the top of that page there, there are some cultural beliefs about anger. Look at the top of page 283 there. It's a knee-jerk reaction. The truth is humans can choose to slow down their reactions and think or behave differently in response to events, okay? Anger can be uncontrollable, resulting in crimes of passion, such as involuntary manslaughter. In societies that believe that anger can be controlled, there are far fewer violent crimes than in the United States. Compare the situation of Japan and the United States. Think of the Japanese and their responses compared to some of ours, okay? Anger behavior in adulthood is determined by temperament and childhood experiences. Temperament and early experiences are important. Emotional development continues throughout your life. Adults can acquire knowledge and skills to handle emotions more effectively. There is a concept now, and you've probably heard of it, called emotional IQ. Not just intellect, but emotional IQ. How well you manage your emotions, how well you look and respect other people's emotions. That has to do with your communication, your soft skills, your sensitivity to others. Also, your intuition. I saw two nurses go to work at the same time facility that I worked at, okay? Both had high-level positions. Both were high-level in management. And one was, I mean, she was a whiz at numbers and all this, you know, all of those kinds of things, but she had no soft skills. The other one wasn't quite as fast with the numbers, but she was intuitive. She read the environment. She had the ability to communicate well with people, recognize situations, soothe situations, handle employees. Who do you think lasted the longest? the one with the soft skills. And that had the intuition to relate and react to others in an appropriate way. Men are angry than women. Women express anger a little differently than men, but societal constraints may inhibit men in expressing it. Now, there's one thing you can take about men. They can go out and brawl in the street, wallow in the mud, and when they're done, what do they say? Want to go get a beer? They're kind of done with that, aren't they? In many ways. Women, not so much. Women remember what you did in 1492 when you came over with Columbus. Women say things like, that's a cute dress that little girl has on, bless her heart. We give, you know, mixed kind of signals, don't we? So people have to behave aggressively to get what they want, and that's simply not true. What, simple requests are just as good. But the importance of this concept as nursing is you're going to see it, you're going to deal with it, and you're going to have to learn how to respond to it, okay? And what? There are physiological symptoms that go along with anger, or they're not. People get red in the face, their voice gets high, their body gets tense, right? They may even get a little aggressive. Some people, what, can have learned to walk off and count to 10. Some people, not so much. The way you express it, what, is important. Can you talk about it? Can you express it in a communicative style? Can you express it without being physical, without being violent, those kinds of things? It's really funny. If you look on page 284, and I'm just using your book right now, the physiological arousal, you know, the tachycardia, your blood pressure goes up, you're red in the face, very similar in people, okay? But the most way that people express it may be a little different. Look on table 19.2. That's on the bottom of that page. There's anger suppression. There's the unhealthy outward anger expression. And there's constructive anger expression, okay? And you can see it goes from suppressing it to where you feel it. And what? Sometimes girls are not supposed to be angry, right? We're supposed to be nice and sweet. Unhealthy, you can read that, and then being constructive where you can talk about it, approach the person, using eye language. There is a form of communication called assertive communication. Have you heard of that, being assertive? When you say this to me, I feel this way, it has more with talking about how you feel about the situation, and it's a lot of eye communication. It is okay to be assertive, but you have to remember one thing. An intuitive person knows when assertiveness is appropriate and when it's not. You might not want to go up to your head nurse and say something that may not be taken well that day. You know, an assertive person looks at the situation. She looks at the temperament. Let me give you an example. If I walked in a room and I was going to have a staff meeting and I saw my staff was pretty upset. We'd had a couple codes that day. Would I follow that agenda that I had just set out to do? Probably not, right? Probably want to talk about what went on the unit that day, how people handled it, how did they feel about it? Did they feel we did a good job? Could we do anything better? You know, let people what? Debrief some. Sometimes you change what you're going to talk about, what? Based on what you see and feel and your intuition, okay? Now, if you look at in the nurse-patient relationship on page 285, it is true that nurses sometimes can withdraw anger from patients, and what do? We try to hide our anger at them because what? Good nurses don't get angry. So we have to be... if we don't consider anger appropriate and we have an agitated patient, okay, and we've been taught to suppress our anger, this is what we call, you know, the countertransference thought there, then what happens? You think we're going to be, if we don't kind of work through that and learn that people are agitated sometimes, it is okay, that our job is what? To help them work through it, express it appropriately, and try to what? Resolve it. Look for what?
Solutions.
The solution, okay? Personality disorders, like Dr. Alexander talked about earlier, they can kind of pick people. They can determine that, yeah, I can get a rise out of her pretty quickly. Watch this. So some patients have that ability, what? To make the nurse agitated. So you've got to really think about yourself and how that makes you feel and how you're going to handle it, okay, if you've got that ability. Now, we know there are many psychiatric conditions that we talked about, personality disorders, PTSD, people who are hallucinating or have delusions. Would you think sometimes an inappropriate expression of anger could come from those types of diagnoses? Also, persons who've had cerebral vascular accidents, who've had head injuries, a lot of trauma. You think they could get angry pretty easily or express it inappropriately? So you've got to think about it. It doesn't just occur if you look on page 286 in your psychiatric problems, but it occurs in other areas of the facility too. And sometimes it's not the patient that's angry. It can be the family. You've seen angry families? You know, you put soft restraints on somebody. On little Grammy, my little Grammy, okay? You put soft restraints on little Grammy because I've got an IV and I've got an NG tube and I've got a catheter. I've got all of those things. And you know, the more that I pull those out and the more you put those back in, what? What increases there?
Risk for infection.
The chances of infection. What? The bladder's an organ. It's a sterile cavity. You don't want to stick, the skin is what? That's your main line of defense, right? You don't want to run an NG tube up and down my nostrils because I probably breathe better out of one than I do the other. Yeah, all of those things. So so I leave and I come back and you've got soft wrist restraints on me. If you don't talk to the family about why, what do you hear family say sometimes? They just tied mama up like a dog. Walked in there and they just had her tied up. And really what? A lot of times you can say, I can take the soft wrist restraint off of her hand while you're here if you're going to hold her hand and sit right by her and keep her from pulling the tubes out. We don't want her to pull the tubes out because she has to have them right now. We don't want to keep restarting an IV, re-putting in a catheter. You know, explain those things. And do you think I'd feel a little better about it if you told me that?
Probably.
And anger is one of the emotions that you can hear in somebody's speech. You know, we've all got what? Emotions. Humor, laughter, sadness. Right? So you have to hear somebody, hear the speech. And people across, different cultures, different backgrounds, different countries, their inflection may be a little differently in their speech. Gender, think about that, is important. So how are we going to keep these people from what are we going to do? The first step is what? Prevention. Look for the solution. Anger management, okay? Look on page 287 about it's the second paragraph. The desired outcomes of any anger management intervention is to teach people to modulate. In other words, when I start feeling my pulse increase, my face getting red, my blood pressure going up, what? That should be a signal to me, right? That I might be getting angry. Or as one patient told me, I'm not angry, I'm just pissed off. Well, and then what? And then you have to teach people to think about, are there irrational thoughts fueling the anger? Is it real or is it unreal? And we know with psychiatric patients, what? A lot of it can be unreal. And a lot of it can be real. If I'm angry because my food was cold and I was hungry and I waited 4 hours for it and then it came cold and dried up, what? That's real, isn't it? But if I'm talking to someone that is not there and having auditory hallucinations and they're trying to kill me, what? Even though that is unreal, it's real to me and can stimulate that emotion, right? So think about that. So, and a lot of times too, you know, we want to work on them in modifying those behaviors, like quit blaming, attacking, don't suppress your anger, you need to talk about it, those kinds of things. And sometimes people do need to go to cognitive behavioral therapy to learn anger management, right? We know what that is, right? Now, if you turn your page, go on over to 288, and we're talking about aggression, impulsivity, and violence. We know what those are, don't we? You can have aggressive language. You can have aggressive body language. You can be aggressive. You can be very impulsive, right? I think this is interesting. Aggression occurs in situations of anger and anxiety when the frontal cortex does not rein in amygdala, resulting in behaviors comparable to a wild horse. You've seen wild horses. What do? They run, they kick, they hee-haw, they bite people, they kick people. They'll run over them if they can, right? Instrumental aggression, on the other hand, is premeditated and unrelated to immediate feelings of frustrations or a threat, as in acts committed in cold blood. In other words, I plan aggression. I plan to shoot somebody. I plan to beat them up. Does that make sense to you? There's impulsive anger, okay, and then there's instrumental, aggression where it's premeditated. Most anger with patients, you think, is what? Is impulsive. It's not instrumental as far as those go. You can kind of read through those theories. They're pretty straightforward. You can just read through those. What I think is most important, okay, is how are we going to assess these folks? Nurses, what are we going to do?
Use a soothing therapeutic voice.
We're going to do that.
Biden won Michigan.
We're going to be soothing and very therapeutic. So turn to page 289, okay? And there's that gentle aggression model, okay? Where you, that's the framework that kind of talks about aggressive action. If you turn the next page, it's got a model. You don't have to memorize this model, but what's important about the model is it talks about the framework. It talks about there may be a situational factors, a social interaction, and how that person thinks about it, perceives it, arouses them, okay? And their gender, their personality traits, attitudes, goals, values, their cognition, what they're thinking, and their mood, okay? Kind of can what? All precipitate an anger episode, okay? So you think about it, it's kind of ongoing. I may have a social encounter, I go up and I look, go up to that line, I see biological modifiers, environmental modifiers, personality, person, situation, what I think about it, how I feel about it, does it arouse those symptoms in me? Do I praise it very closely? Do I do thoughtful action or do I do impulsive action? Remember we said impulsive action is more what patients do, okay? Not the premeditated form. And that's kind of a model. And all you got to do is think about person, personality, situation, factors in that situation. What's that person thinking, feeling? What are they going to do? Are they going to be impulsive? Are they going to sit back and appraise it and talk about it? You follow me there? I'm getting some yeses? Okay. A lot of times, too, if a person It says age, gender, and race of patients are not a good predictor. Research says that particular characteristics, and underline this just for your future reference, are that are predictive of violent behaviors or involuntary hospitalization. Who are we talking about there? Our psych patients, aren't we? Paranoid, suspicious people. Because what can I do? I can think you're the nurse, but you're really working for the FBI, and they sent you in there to implant this battery in my brain because I'm the smartest person in the world and you just want my thoughts.
Delusional.
Or I can think the TV's talking to me, ideas of, you know, a reference. I can be mad at the news person on the TV because they're talking to me, okay? People who are very impulsive. People who get agitated very easily. And, of course, you know, there are rules that we all have to follow. And if I'm not a rule follower and I get mad about having to follow them, what happens? I can get angry. Now, that's what I told you a minute ago also, too. Schizophrenics, particularly paranoid ones. Anybody that's paranoid, just be careful. Bipolar, if I'm manic and I want to what? Dance on the pool table and throw balls at people. I think that's kind of fun. Brain injuries, okay? Particularly like frontal lobe injuries where all your emotions and all that are there. The limbic area of the brain. Persons who are in any kind of alcohol or drug withdrawal. And attention deficit, particularly those that are hyperactive, okay? Teacher said to me, they had a child who was very, very hyperactive. Sometimes the parents forget to give them the medicine. And you can tell because they're up under the desk, and one minute they're saying, oh, I love you, you're such a nice teacher. The next minute they're saying, I hate you, I just want to, and spitting at them and taking a swat at the teacher. No medication. And there are some what? Attention deficit disorders that need medication. Only what? If they are appropriately what? Analyzed and diagnosed. Not just because I'm a little higher, I want to, you know, not see them sometimes. So there's the STAMP model that they talk about, okay? Staring. I'm going to glare at you. How many of you have children? Do they know the look?
Yes, they do.
So your mama's well. Look?
Very well.
Did you know your mama's look when you were growing up? When you got the look and you got the tone, what had to happen there?
Sit down, be quiet.
Something has changed.
You're done.
Uh-huh. I was laughing one time at I saw one of my daughters in the bathroom and they were trying to raise their eyebrow. You know,
giving the look.
And I said, what are you doing? Just working it, raising their eyebrow. And I said, what are you doing? She said, well, I'm trying to raise my eyebrow like you do when you're mad at us. Yeah, so you got the eyebrow look there. And the tone, the volume. So, you know, what happens? That's what? Anxiety in patients, people that are mumbling under their breath. And a lot of times what? If somebody's pacing. That means they're anxious and uncomfortable. They don't communicate well. They've got a lot of physical problems, okay? Some of our stroke patients, okay, that have lost use of a hand or an arm or a leg or speech, and they're trying to communicate with you, just get very agitated and very frustrated, okay? And you will see that. And at some point in time, what? You just have to give them a rest period. Matter of fact, sometimes you have to tell the therapist, I think we're good for today. And sometimes a good therapist will recognize, you know, good occupational therapist or PT or, but a lot of times those patients get extremely frustrated because what? Any neurological damage that you have is hindsight. You don't know what's going to totally, how the brain's going to reorganize itself. And that takes time. And not being able to have an answer and talk with that, you know, and give an answer can frustrate not only that patient, but it can frustrate the family. So societal factors. Think of patients, families right now with what all is going on in 2020 could be extremely frustrated. Loss of jobs, loss of money, maybe the quarantine can bring out what? Not always the best. The child abuse gone up. I have a colleague that is a sane nurse, and it also has to go out on some, you know, child abuse causes, and has gone out a lot more in the past 6 months than ever before. And seen some horrendous things related to child abuse and family violence. So the therapeutic milieu, okay? We talk about that, but we have to be careful about a busy hospital unit that's loud. You know, you don't go to the hospital to rest, do you? Mm-hmm. You know, just about time I get to sleep at 9 o'clock, here's somebody going to come in and take my vital signs. And I'm thinking, okay, why couldn't you have taken that? I'm stable, leave me alone for the night.
We were just talking about that with MedSurg, about how we felt bad because we keep waking up our patients and it can't be good for them to heal or anything like that because we just keep waking them up and waking them up.
We do. So that's sometimes if somebody, you know that somebody has not slept, they're stable, their vital signs are stable, can you just kind of ease in and check on them and maybe talk with the doc about, hey, I'm going to let them sleep tonight if that's okay with you. I'm going to check on them. You know, can you do that? Yeah, can. That's called being a patient advocate, okay? And then a lot of times, too, on a psych unit, okay, one patient can disturb the whole unit. That's why it's important. Important not just to think about therapeutic milieu on a psych unit, but on a med-surg unit too. What if I have, you're on a maternal child unit where women have just had babies and I just lost a baby. Do you want to put me in the middle of that hall where I can hear everybody's baby crying and the nursery and all that? Would that be very therapeutic for me?
No.
So you have to think about things like that. If you have, look in box 19.5, and those are little predictors of things that are going on a unit that will make it have a tendency to be more patient violent. Rigidity, lack of privacy, autonomy, hierarchy of authority, lack of patient control, denial, all of those things. I can guarantee you that most of the times when a patient gets angry, their feelings have been hurt, and it's something somebody said. So what are the interventions? It's things that we've talked about. Communication, okay? You go back to chapter 9, you know, and you look on that chart in there, it talks about what? Therapeutic communication. Let me sit with you for a while. My whole goal when I see some patients being angry when we're on a unit, okay, is to remove them from all the stimulation for a while, get them somewhere where it's quieter, that they can sit down. Why do I want them down? I don't want to be sucker punched. I want to get them down and out of my face, right?
She doesn't get time to answer at all.
If they're in the bed, you know, it's always good to keep somebody in a semi-Fowler's position, isn't it? If you can't think of any other question on a test to mark and they've got a semi-Fowler's position, most of the time it's going to be right.
Tomorrow.
You lift them up. They can see. They don't get as confused. You take the pressure off their head. You know, there's a lot of good things about that, right? They can swallow better. So what do I want to do? Listen, 92% of us are big mouths, 92% of the population. There's about 8% that are quiet. So what? We have to really, some of us really have to concentrate what? On listening. And if somebody's on that call, Bill,